Hi, writers. I'm glad we are together for our new episode on writing fiction. This is Jim Thayer, and I have been writing fiction. My new novel, Fagin and Miss Havisham, is now available at Amazon for ebook download, in print, and soon in Audible format, published by the publisher Creative Texts. In these podcasts on writing fiction, I talk the talk. But can I also walk the walk? I hope so, and I hope you'll want to find out. The novel is set in London in the 1820s, and when my wife Patty read the novel a week ago, she said, "You sure mention the smells a lot." Yes, London in the 1820s had a lot of smells, and you've heard me mention the technique of adding smells to a setting. It's a strong technique, so there's at least one technique I did right, the smells. Please consider getting a copy of my new novel, Fagin and Miss Havisham. I'd like to talk today about a strong technique, one that's not always obvious, and it's one new writers often don't know. It's this: we should always try to have elements of our story do double duty. Elements in our fiction should do two things at the same time. Double duty means to make each element in our story serve multiple purposes. And this means going beyond a simple description. The reader should be given a description of the character or the setting or dialogue or action, but also should be given something else. The description should suggest something more, something beyond the description. So the formula is 1, describe, 2, suggest. A longer version: we should describe the setting or character or action or dialogue, and that description should infer something beyond the mere description. Let's look at how good writers do this and how we might do it ourselves. First, let's mention physical descriptions of our character. As you know, our character we are creating in our story should be described right away, within sentences of the first time the reader meets her in our pages. The reason is that a character who is not described remains a vague smear in the reader's mind, and the character can't engage the reader. A character who is described has an image in the reader's mind, an image the reader can focus on. The reader has a picture of the character. But the reader should receive more than a picture from our description. The reader should also get an inclination of the character. And here's the key. Each item or mannerism that the writer, that we choose to describe the character, should do double duty. It should create an image, and it should reveal or show something important about the character. Here is a description from Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere, a description of two of the main villains in the story. This is Neil Gaiman. "There are 4 simple ways for the observant to tell Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar apart. First, Mr. Vandemar is 2.5 heads taller than Mr. Croup. Second, Mr. Croup has eyes of a faded china blue, while Mr. Vandemar's eyes are brown. Third, while Mr. Vandemar fashioned the rings he wears on his right hand out of the skulls of 4 ravens, Mr. Croup has no obvious jewelry. Fourth, Mr. Croup likes words, while Mr. Vandemar is always hungry. Also, they look nothing alike." That's Neil Gaiman. This is funny, but it also sets a dark mood, as we get the impression from their physical descriptions that Croup and Vandemar will do anything, and it's most always bad. This physical description sets a tense mood, and it also telegraphs that things will soon become dangerous for the novel's heroes, Richard and Dor, the character named Dor. This is from, watch Sarah Gruen do the same thing in her wonderful novel, Water for Elephants. This is the first description of Marlena. I'm searching in vain for an elephant when my eyes come to an abrupt stop on a woman. She looks so much like Catherine, I catch my breath. The plane of her face, the cut of her hair, the slim thighs. She's standing in front of a row of black and white horses, wearing pink sequins, tights, and satin slippers, talking to a man in a top hat and tails. She cups the muzzle of one of the white horses, a striking Arabian with a silver mane and tail. She lifts a hand to push back a piece of her light brown hair and adjust her headdress. Then she reaches up and smooths the horse's forelock against his face. She grasps his ear in her fist, letting it slide through her fingers. That's Sarah Gruen. The reader here learns of Marlena's face and her clothing. She's a circus performer. But the reader also learns of her love of horses, which in fiction almost always telegraphs that the person is kind and caring. The reader likes Marlena from this one short description, from her smoothing the horse's forelock and playing with the horse's ear. She is a character the reader will root for. This description of Marlena is doing double duty, a physical description of her and a description of her personality. Here is Gene Shepherd's description of Daphne Bigelow in his collection of short stories titled Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters, which is one of the funniest and most entertaining books I've ever read. This is Gene Shepherd. Her name was Daphne Bigelow. Her skin was of the clearest, rarest form of pure, translucent alabaster. She had no eyes in the mundane sense, but rather she saw the world, or the world saw her, through twin jade green jungle pools, mirrors of a soul that was so mysterious, so enigmatic, as to baffle ninth graders for yards around. I hesitate to use such pitifully inadequate words such as hair to describe the nimbus of magic, that shifting cloud of iridescence that framed a face of such surpassing beauty that even Buddha would have thought long and hard before staring straight into it. There was something else about her, something I am not sure I can adequately convey through the sadly lacking means of imperfect human language. Daphne walked in a kind of soft haze of approaching dawn. A suggestion always lingered about her that she wasn't there at all. That's Gene Shepherd. This is a funny description of Daphne, and we are meant to laugh at the narrator's description of this ninth-grade goddess. But the author Gene Shepherd is also telling us something about the first-person narrator, Ralph. Daphne is unobtainable, and Ralph is going to get crushed when he tries. Gene Shepherd is alerting us readers in his description of Daphne, in Ralph's over-the-top description, that Ralph will learn a lot about life and that it'll be funny for us readers when he does. This description of Daphne also shows the reader that Ralph has a short horizon. All of this is set out in the several sentences of Daphne's description. Gene Shepherd's description of Daphne is doing double duty. Ralph here is the little boy in A Christmas Story, the TV show. You remember the You'll Shoot Your Eye Out BB Gun and the fabulous Major Award leg lamp. It's the same boy 6 years older when he's in ninth grade. Gene Shepherd is one of my favorite writers. Here is my version of an inert description of a character. This description is not doing double duty. It's only doing one thing. It's a description. Smith wore a green jacket and blue jeans. A black watch cap covered his hair. His hair was closely cropped and his ears stood out like jug handles. He stared at the approaching bus. We have a description of Smith that is only a description of Smith. But if we add a few phrases, the description will do double duty. Here it is again. Smith's green jacket was frayed at the sleeves, and his blue jeans were ragged at the ankles. Grease smeared the black watch cap that covered his head. Half of his left ear was missing, and as he watched the approaching bus, his hands trembled. This description of Smith does double duty. It gives the reader an image of the character, and it also relays something about Smith's background. He's poor, with his ragged and dirty clothing, and he has been the object of violence with his missing half an ear. He may be cold or sick, and as his hands are trembling. So here the reader learns of his background and maybe his personality. The reader doesn't know what these things mean at this point, but Smith clearly is in trouble. So this my second version of the description of Smith is doing double duty. It describes him, and it shows the reader something about him. We can do double duty in our character descriptions. We can also do it in our descriptions of settings. Here is Charles Dickens in A Christmas Carol. Once upon a time, of all the good days in the year, on Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house. It was cold, bleak, biting weather, foggy withal, and he could hear the people in the court outside go wheezing up and down, beating their hands upon their breasts and stamping their feet upon the pavement stones to warm them. The city clocks had only just gone 3, but it was quite dark already. It had not been light all day, and candles were flaring in the windows of the neighboring offices like ruddy smears upon the palpable brown air. The fog came pouring in at every chink and keyhole, and was so dense without that, although the court was of the narrowest, the houses opposite were mere phantoms. To see this dingy cloud come drooping down, obscuring everything, one might have thought that nature lived hard by and was brewing on a large scale. Charles Dickens turns to a description of Scrooge's office at the counting house. The door of Scrooge's counting house was open, that he might keep his eye upon his clerk, who in a dismal little cell beyond, a sort of tank, was copying letters. Scrooge had a very small fire, but the clerk's fire was so very much smaller that it looked like one coal. But he couldn't replenish it, for Scrooge kept the coal box in his own room, and so surely as the clerk came in with the shovel, the master predicted that it would be necessary for them to part. Wherefore, the clerk put on his white comforter and tried to warm himself at the candle, in which effort, not being a man of strong imagination, he failed. Charles Dickens, both in his settings inside and outside, is making the reader feel cold. Everything's cold and gray. And that is a description of the setting. It also gives the reader a lot of information about Ebenezer Scrooge. Dickens's setting descriptions are doing double duty. Here is John Steinbeck doing the same thing in The Grapes of Wrath. This is the first sentences of the novel, and they're just beautiful. To the red country and part of the gray country of Oklahoma, the last rains came gently, and they did not cut the scarred earth. The plows crossed and recrossed the rivulet marks. The last rains lifted the corn quickly and scattered weed colonies and grass along the sides of the road, so that the gray country and the dark red country began to disappear under a green cover. In the last part of May, the sky grew pale, and the clouds that had hung in high puffs for so long in the spring were dissipated. The sun flared down on the growing corn day after day until a line of brown spread along the edge of each green bayonet. The clouds appeared and went away, and in a while they did not try any more. The weeds grew darker green to protect themselves, and they did not spread any more. The surface of the earth crusted, a thin, hard crust, and as the sky became pale, so did the earth become pale. pink in the red country, and white in the gray country. Wow, what writing. Not only does Steinbeck describe the setting in these lyrical phrases, he also suggests to the reader that the land has broken hearts. The sun flared, the earth crusted, the clouds went away. We know from this paragraph that the land, the setting, has broken farmers and chased them away. Oklahoma in the 1930s became the Dust Bowl, and shattered plans and dreams of families, and sometimes it shattered families. We learn of the people's motivation to get away from this place. This paragraph of setting description suggests the mood of the entire novel. This writing is doing double duty. It isn't inert. Here is Oscar Wilde in the picture of Dorian Gray. The description of the setting, this setting, is in the first pages of the novel. Notice what Oscar Wilde is saying about Henry Wotton, even though the author is ostensibly describing the setting. Here's Oscar Wilde. The studio was filled with the rich odor of roses, and when the light summer wind stirred amidst the trees of the garden, there came through the open door the heavy scent of the lilac, or the more delicate perfume of the pink flowering thorn. From the corner of the divan of Persian saddlebags on which he was lying, smoking, as was his custom, innumerable cigarettes, Lord Henry Wotton could just catch the gleam of the honey-sweet and honey-colored blossoms of the laburnum, whose tremulous branches seem hardly able to bear the burden of beauty so flame-like as theirs. And now and then the fantastic shadows of birds in flight flitted across the long tussore silk curtains that were stretched in front of the huge window, producing a kind of momentary Japanese effect, and making him think of those pallid, jade-faced painters of Tokyo. The sullen murmur of the bees shouldering their way through the long unmown grass, of circling with monotonous insistence round the dusty gilt horns of the straggling woodbine, seemed to make the stillness more oppressive. The dim roar of London was like the bourbon note of a distant organ. This is Oscar Wilde's description of a sitting room, but the main effect of this setting description is of the reader's impression of Lord Henry Wotton. He is largely without ambition. He doesn't work for a living. His judgments are often shallow. We learn this about him because he would sit there smoking on a Persian divan, making these deep but worthless observations. He has too much time on his hands, and this is made clear in the setting description. And so this setting description is doing double duty, telling us about the room and the garden, but also telling us about Henry Wotton. This having our setting description do double duty is important, and it's not hard to do. Here is a short description of a setting that does not do double duty, and so it's inert. I wrote this. The whirligig went round and round, and the roller coaster roared by, its wheels clacking. Allison smelled cotton candy and hot dogs. The funhouse was painted red and yellow with red neon lights that read, Magic Mansion. The funhouse had balconies and windows, and the facade was painted in day-glow green and red. Three clown heads were also painted on the house, one with puffy red hair and one with bouffant green hair. This isn't too bad of a description of where Allison is. She's at a county fair. But it's only a description. It's an image without more. It's inert. Listen to how we can juice it up so that the description does double duty. Here's the same thing again with a few changes. The whirligig went round and round, and the roller coaster roared by, its wheels clacking. Allison smelled cotton candy and hot dogs, and she didn't notice the coaster and the whirligig were both empty. The funhouse was painted red and yellow with red neon lights that read Magic Mountain. The funhouse had balconies and windows, and the facade was painted in a day glow green and red. Three clown heads were also painted on the house, one with puffy red hair and one with bouffant green hair. Both clowns' eyes appeared to move, following her as she approached the Magic Mansion. Here, a few additional phrases set the mood. This is a horror story, and things are awry. That things aren't normal at this county fair is conveyed to the reader. The whirligig and the roller coaster are empty, and the clowns appear that are painted on the side of the funhouse appear to be following her with her eyes. The mood's tense, and it's made so in the setting description. The setting here is doing double duty. It's alerting the reader to the mood of the novel. Or let's say we want the setting to convey, the same setting, the county fair, to convey a romantic mood. We could show a boy and a girl, a boy and girl teenagers kissing as they ride the whirligig, and another pair holding hands at one of the funhouse balconies. And instead of threatening clowns on the side of the funhouse, several hearts are painted on the funhouse wall. So our descriptions of settings should do double duty. One, they should describe, and two, they should suggest. The same thing is true with dialogue. Here is William Sloane in his book, The Craft of Writing. There is a tentative rule that pertains to all fiction dialogue. It must do more than one thing at a time, or it is too inert for the purposes of fiction. This may sound harsh, but I consider it an essential discipline. And then William Sloane goes on, not only should the dialogue be a transcription of what was said in the scene, it should also offer clues to the characters who are speaking, or provide information, or establish the setting, or establish the mood. Here is from Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn regarding his father, who Huckleberry calls Pap. Now, Huckleberry is speaking to the reader. This is a first-person novel, and listen to Huckleberry's dialogue. Whenever his liquor begun to work, he most always went for the government. This time he says, "Call this a government? Why, just look at it and see what it's like. Here, the law is standing ready to take a man's son away from him, a man's own son, which he has had all the trouble and all the anxiety and all the expense of raising. Yes, just as that man has got that son raised at last and ready to go to work and begun to do something for him and give him a rest, the law up and goes for him, and they call that government. That ain't all, neither. The law takes a man worth $6,000 and upwards and jams him into an old trap of a cabin like this and lets him go round in clothes that ain't fitten. They call that government. A man can't get his rights in a government like this. Sometimes I've a mighty notion to just leave this country for good and all. Yes, and I told him so." This is Pap's dialogue, and we are reading a transcription of what Pap is saying to Huckleberry. Pap is one of the worst persons in literature. But we are also learning a lot about Huckleberry, who's just listening to his father. We learn how hard Huck's life is dealing with this drunken, worthless sot of a father who does nothing but take advantage of Huckleberry. In this dialogue from Pap, we infer much of the hardship of Huck's childhood and his present life, and we also learn how desperate Huck must be to escape, which he does. We can also use the double duty technique when writing action. Here's a short example where Joni is climbing a ladder. Here's the inert version. Gripping the rails, Joni stepped onto the ladder's first rung. The stepladder was 10 feet tall, and a can of blue paint rested on the ladder's shelf. She moved her foot up to the next rung. Well, we, the writer, have to get Joni up the ladder, and we are doing so. And this description of the action is less interesting than the ingredients on my Tootsie Roll wrapper. But how about making Joni afraid of heights? This adds a new dimension. Here it is again. Gripping the rails, Joni stepped onto the ladder's first rung. She inhaled sharply and closed her eyes. The stepladder was 10 feet tall, and a can of blue paint rested on the ladder shelf. She moved her foot up to the next rung. Her hands were so tight around the sides of the ladder that her knuckles were white. Here, with a couple additional phrases, we've shown a lot about Joni. She's afraid of heights. We can work this fear into our story later, or we can come up with something else to show the reader as she climbs the ladder. So our action, her climbing the ladder, is doing double duty. As an aside, I fell off a ladder once. It's only about 5 feet, but I landed on concrete. The cause of this mishap, as you have already concluded regarding an incident involving a ladder, was carelessness. Not just carelessness, but advanced carelessness, my own. And it was an unpleasant experience through and through. There's very little give in concrete. So there's the double duty technique, and it's a good one. We can ask ourselves when we write a character description or a setting description or when we write dialogue or action, is our paragraph doing more than one thing? Does our paragraph, one, describe, and two, suggest? If so, our paragraph is likely first rate. We have come to the end of this episode. My address is jimthayerseattle@gmail.com. I'll see you next time, and I'm already looking forward to it. Until then, please keep tapping those keys.